ॐ पार्थाय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणी.
Let's start with 7, because, well, we're going to chant always from verse 7 now, so we get used to memorize this, these qualities, okay?
Om amani tvamatam bitvam. Om amani tvamatam bitvam. Ahim sakshantir arjavam. Ahim sakshantir arjavam. Acharyo pasanam shaucham. Acharyo pasanam shaucham. Staryam atma vinigraha. Staryam atma vinigraha. Indriyarteshu vairagyam. Indriyarteshu vairagyam. Anahankara evacha. Anahankara evacha. Janma mrityu jara vyadhi. Janma mrityu jara vyadhi. Dukkadoshanu darshanam. Dukkadoshanu darshanam.
So verse 8. Indriya arteshu, indriya arta, indriya arteshu, vairagyam, anahankaraha, eva cha, janma, mrityu, jara, vyadhi, dukkha, dosha, anudarshanam. Okay. The first one. Indriyarteshu, locative plural, in the objects, in the sense objects. Artha means the objects of the indriyas. The indriyas are the sense objects. So the indriyas are the sense organs. So the indriya artha is the objects of the sense organs, so sense objects. So in reference to, so locative can be like in, toward, in reference to, regarding. So in reference to the sense objects, there is vairagya. So the one who has vairagya, toward the sense objects. Then anahankaraha, the one who is free from ahankara. So ahankara, where the anahankara negates the ahankara. So here, because these are qualities, for really the mumukshu, they're not really talking here about the qualities of the jnani, but the qualities of the mumukshu. Here the anahankara will say freedom from pride, but I'll get into that. So the anahankaraha, one who's without that ego. So anahankaraha, eva indeed, cha. So now we've got two, indriyarteshu, vairagyam, and then anahankaraha, and then jan, this last one is one whole compound, the whole line. Janma means birth, mrityu, death, jara, old age, vyadhi, sickness, dukkha, suffering, dosha is a defect. Dosha is a defect. Anudarshanam, for the one who is anudarshana, who is seeing over and over again. That anu means repeatedly. Anudarshanam, darshana means seeing. For the one who is seeing, sees over and over again, seeing, we'd say like this, the seeing over and over again of the dosha. The dosha means that defect or that limitation, which is suffering, which is sorrow, caused by birth, death, old age, and suffering, and disease, and illness. The one who understands or recognizes the suffering that's just caused really by the human condition, you know, even without anything going wrong, just by the mere fact of having a physical form, there's the suffering of birth, death, old age, and illness. Okay? So the one who understands the human condition in that way. Let's go to the first one. Indriyarteshu vairagya. Swamiji does a very nice unfoldment of this.
bringing in this term that we haven't used much. It's called Shobhana Adhyasa. The word Shobhana means beauty or something that's very attractive or very appealing. The Adhyasa is the superimposition of that Shobhana, of that thinking, like, for instance, in the world, not everything lights up for you in the same way. The things that you go after, the things that you desire, those things you have, in one way or another, superimposed your own well-being or your own wholeness or your own fullness upon, your own beauty upon, in the sense of, if I could have this, that would be so good for me, that would be so nice. This thing is beautiful. This is something that I want. So the beauty of the beauty that which is projected upon a desired object to make you desire it, that's called Shobhana. So with Vairagya, dispassion, Vairagya, what happens as one gains Vairagya, this Shobhana Adhyasa starts to subside. Because, in fact, just like the animal crackers, every nama rupa, every name and form in the creation really has the same being for its substance. And the being that it has for its substance is my being. There is only one being, there's only one ananda, there's only one wholeness or fullness. And every nama rupa is a manifestation of that one Satchidananda. And so there is no objectified ananda. Let me put this, you cannot objectify ananda. There's not an object ananda. There's not a wholeness object or a fullness object. There's not even a beautiful object. Even beauty. Somebody wrote a whole book on this. The Shobhana Adhyasa of beauty itself. What is beautiful and sacred and so wonderful to one person could not be attractive to another person at all. You know? I'll tell this story that Swamiji used to tell all the time. He hasn't told it for a long time. It's kind of a weird story. And actually he feels bad about this. Happened when he was a young boy. Okay? There was this young woman who was going to be married just outside of his village. And Swamiji and I think and his brothers and some people had to go to that village to see this woman for some reason. I forget the whole story. But this woman had no neck. In other words, her neck was just, she was fine, I mean, nothing wrong with her. It's just she had no neck because she was a little heavy and her chin and everything were so sitting right on her shoulders as though. And so Swamiji thought this was really funny looking, this young woman that didn't have any neck, he didn't think that she was very pretty. There wasn't any Shobhana Adhyasa in his part, okay? And so he was wondering about it, you know. How could that be? How could that be? And then he realized when he met the young man that was going to marry this woman, this young man, you could tell just by the radiance of his face and the way that he looked at her, that to this man, this woman was very beautiful. And then Swamiji, it changed him. He was a young boy here. I mean, he was like a young teenager. This thing, he never forgot it. And he realized this kind of cliche that we all know, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You know? And that really, there is no such thing. The beauty is the ananda of the atma, of the self, that your mind, when your mind has a shantavritti in reference to any object, it superimposes that ananda or that beauty, that shobhana, upon the object and then you seek it. You know? If something to one person is very beautiful you know, and inspiring. And somehow that same object has created some sort of a distance or pressure, you know, or negative reaction in another person. But that other person, there is no Shobhana Adhyasa. There is no projection of beauty onto that person or onto the object. It's all relative. So whether it's beauty or ananda, of fullness or well-being, or even, you know, seeing the other person as a good person or bad person, it's all Shobhana Adhyasa, or the absence, the opposite, you know. And so with vairagya, what happens is a person matures, and the maturing in light of this knowledge is the re-owning of the Shobhana, of the ananda. So that the mind, just with any, like any projection, even in psychology, you know, and we're just dealing with the mind, how the mind projects all kinds of things, all kinds of hurts and pains that you're storing inside get projected on the other person, and then you react to the other person. All these are just projections. We all know, we always talk about projections. This is the deepest level of projection, where your very being is projected onto objects. And then when any object can receive that projection, then you go after it. But projections require, any projection on any level of the mind, it requires ajnanam, it requires ignorance of the source of the projection. If you're aware of the source of the projection, then it doesn't get projected. It's just like if you're aware of the rope, you can't see the snake. Right? It won't come, the snake can't come, because you see the rope. If you're aware of the source of the pain or the source of the ananda, then the mind no longer projects that. It enjoys that source. So with vairagya, you find as your vairagya, your maturity increases, is what happens more and more is the universe becomes much more objective. You become much more objective toward the world in that. And how that manifests is that you have the freedom to allow the world to be as it is. You're not asking you this asking or need for a situation to be in a particular way or a person to be in a particular way so that you can be happy. That's what starts being naturally withdrawn as the mind not only recognizes yourself as who is teaching me, well, I'm really the source of ananda. You know, you kind of intellectually know that I really see how I really am the source of ananda. But your mind will do a lot of tricks around that and say, even though I know that I'm really the source of ananda, I still want this to be that way. So we have all kinds of tricks. But after, as time goes on, and you kind of live with your knowledge and your experience and your understanding, the mind less and less asks the world to be different and more sits with your own fullness, which then allows you to engage with the world as it is and to engage with people as they are. So you have to be careful when we talk like this because people will worry. I will always get questions, and Swamiji would always get these kind of questions. Well, does that mean the world becomes flat? In other words, no one in the world evokes any type of positive or negative reaction. You actually become just a feelingless, you know, person. I would say, no, it isn't like that at all. It doesn't have anything to do with that. It's just that it has more to do with this. When your mind has differentiated and recognizes the source of the ananda, the fullness, as your own being. So now there's no distance between that ananda and your mind, because your mind has no distance from really the source of that well-being, which is your own nature. As the mind recognizes that, it more and more sits in that, or as the Gita will say over and over, reveling in that. It revels in that fullness. And from that perspective, you enjoy and you relate to the world. And so all that means from the perspective of the other and from the perspective as you, of you, is that you're enjoying the other person as they are. instead of being irritated with the other person as they are. Because I'm free enough to enjoy you because my ananda is not dependent on you being in a particular way. So that's why when you're with a jnani or with somebody like Swamiji, somebody who's mature, really mature in their knowledge, what your experience is that you feel loved and wanted, and you feel like you are seen, who you really are is seen. Because who you really are is Brahman. That's who you really are. That's the person inside. And the other things that are just wafting through are just vrittis. They're like obstructions on a cloudy day, you know, from the standpoint of the other. You know, so say for instance we're relating to each other and one person's mind is muddled. One person's mind is muddled with anger or reaction or whatever it is. So then from your standpoint, what does that mean to you? So how do you hold that? A person's mind is muddled and angry and this and that and responding in this. Is that the person? You know, is that the person or is that a reaction going on? And so say if you know yourself, it's exactly the same. Say there's a reaction going on or something going on. Is that you? From your standpoint, no, it's not you at all. It's what the mind is doing, right? And so you're the one who's illumining that. And that same freedom you have toward whatever funny things are going on in your mind, you're able to have that toward other people, whatever funny things are going on in their mind. But why you can have that is because you're not hurt by it. Or if you're hurt by it, it's like riding on water. And why I say it's like riding on water is because even if the mind has some ripple effect from the response of the world to you, the way the world is treating you at the moment, if there's some effect there, it's riding on water because your mind is not really asking the world to be your source of ananda. If you're asking the world, on whatever level you're asking it, the world to be your source of ananda, then the world is hurtful, you know, because it always disappoints you. You know? And it seems kind of mean that it always disappoints you, but in the end, it does make you a mumukshu. Uh-huh. You know, it does deliver the goods. It makes you a mumukshu because there's no exception. It never decides that, well, this time we'll give you a break. You get a free ride this time. There's no free ride, you know. And everything does come to an end. Every situation, every vritti, every emotion, whatever it be, good or bad, all of it always comes to an end. It's always continually changing. And so at some point, especially as a mumukshu, and you start exposing yourself to teaching, what happens is as you assimilate, as the you start assimilating your knowledge, your mind less and less asks the world or ask people to be different than what they are in a way that is disruptive to your well-being. And that, in fact, is maturity. That's maturity. Where my, in terms of knowledge, and that's the vairagya. It's even a vairagya, they say, and Shankara brings this out in his commentary. That type of vairagya toward all of my experiences in the world, but also toward, and this is very Indian, it's not so much Western, also toward, you know, all of the heavenly lokas. Mm. I can go to Swarga loka, or I could go to this loka, if I can go to the Gandharva loka. And then I could really be a wonderful musician and I can sing well if I could just go to Gandharva Loka, you know. Or I could go to the Swarga Loka. And then I wouldn't have these obstructions getting in the way of fulfilling my desires. As I want, so it will be. So I have a desire to go there just so I can have what I want. I want to go to Gandharva Loka just so that I've always wanted to sing. Now I would be able to sing and really enjoy music fully. Whatever, I can have these type of desires. I have a desire, maybe this life I didn't get to be a good tennis player, but maybe next life I could be a really good tennis player. Who knows what it is? Whatever it is, I can project it out into the future and then hope to fulfill it. Those are also desires. That's also those type of situations would add to my happiness, that they would take care of this problem of my lack of wholeness or my lack of fullness. Well, as you're a mumukshu that even brings you to this knowledge, that's already started to crack and started to wane. But as you gain knowledge and recognize more and more, as you recognize your own shanti, that your being is that wholeness, the more you recognize that, the more you recognize it. You know? The more you see that, the more you see it. And the more you see it, the more you see it. And how that translates into your own mind, your own way of being, is that your mind, because we're all, what do you call it, pragmatic, and we all want really what is easiest and best for ourselves, you know, it is not in our best interest to get upset or bothered about things that really are just like animal crackers. It's not in our best interest. And the mind knows that because the mind loves ananda. Even for the ajnani, who is the samsari, who projects shobhana adhyasa, projects everything on all the happiness and fullness, projects it onto the world. That one loves ananda as much as the jnani. We all love the ananda. We all love to be loved. The problem is, for the ajnani, for the samsari, is that I have projected that experience of being loved, of being whole, onto the world, and then I seek it. And it is like kind of running after a mirage, because I end up getting the objects, but not the ananda. I get only a glimpse of ananda when my mind becomes gains some shanti. That lasts barely a moment, really. And then that closes over and I have the object. But there's no ongoing shanti. So it's like a mirage. And at some point, you know, we start to realize that's what brings, one of the main things that brings us to knowledge in the first place, that seeing through that illusion without knowing the answer. But then as I do know the answer, my mind gets a taste of just enjoying the wholeness of my being and the relaxation, because I don't have to struggle to find me. I have to struggle for anything out here, but I don't have to struggle for my own being. And so I would rather enjoy my being and let Ishwara be. Enjoy my being, and then from that position, from the position of my own ananda, then relate to the world. But because I'm already enjoying that fullness, I'm not asking the world anything from the world. I'm just doing what is to be done, trying to be helpful, you know. In your situation, everybody has their duty, so you try to be helpful in your situation. That's what it is. That's what you end up naturally maturing into. It's not like you have to work at this. The thing is that as you recognize your own wholeness, or you recognize where the wholeness actually is, where the ananda actually resides, then the shobhana adhyasa starts to drop off. When that shobhana, that superimposition of ananda onto the world, drops off, then you relate differently to the world. You know? Just think in all of the situations where find yourself in a situation where you're not asking anything of the situation. You're just there, but you don't need that situation or that person to be in any particular way. That's a great percentage of your time is like that, where everything is really fine. But the problem is, there's always a handful of things that aren't like that. And those handful of things are what my mind circles around. And those are that's my sadhana. It's those handful of things where I have to bring in my knowledge, do the inner child work, you know, do all of those things to allow me to be free in reference to the few things that are actually receiving that shobhana adhyasa. Mm. So that indriyarteshu vairagyam, that just like we're talking about it now, as we're talking about it as a value based upon your understanding. And that value becomes what it would be, what is your sadhana, your understanding of it is your sadhana. That sadhana becomes a sadhya, something that is just naturally accomplished as your mind assimilates your knowledge. You know, all of the different levels of your mind, all the little ones inside, and all of the complexes, and all of the different states of mind in reference to certain things. You can find your knowledge is very well assimilated in this area, but once it moves over here, it's not very well assimilated anymore. So those are what we see as we kind of, you know, mature in the light of our knowledge. It's a process that takes place over time. The next one is anahankaraha. Here, what Shankara says for this anahankaraha, he says, ahankara abhavaha evacha. He's just telling what the nunj is. The nunj is the negative, an. Anahankaraha means absence of ahankara. Here he doesn't say anything more about this. Swamiji says quite a bit of it about it. If it's a, yeah, this is this is his one Shankara's for this is all he says about it. Anahankaraha, ahankara abhavaha evacha. That's it. Means anahankara means the absence of ahankara. That's it. So Swamiji had to go on about it a little bit more than that to unfold it for us, but. Here, if you remember that all of these qualities are why the sannyasi or why the mumukshu chants all of these qualities from the imani to amadambi to all of them is to bring those values to mind. These qualities that on another level for the one who's mature in their knowledge is just a description of who they are. So here the anahankara can't mean to be without ahankara. The only one who can be without an ahankara is the jnani, right? Because what the ahankara means is that I have superimposed my being, who I am, onto an upadhi and a conditioning adjunct. That is the ahankara. Like if I say I am my mind, or I am a feeling, or I am a mood, or I am the physical body, or I am sick, or I am healthy, or I see well, or I don't see well. And all those things, the me, is superimposed on the object. And so, until you have knowledge, an ahankara means the making of an I, putting an I onto something else, putting your being onto something else. Where the aham for a jnani, it's not really the ahankara would be mithya. Because you know exactly what it's just a useful use of the language. But when for Agnani, the aham, the word aham, lands on the I, on yourself, which is Brahman. Right? And so that is for you once you recognize yourself. The aham, when you say I, it resolves into the I, who you really are. It doesn't land on I as the body or I as the mind. And so for me, for Agnani, if you say, I'm going to the store, I don't mean I've just all of a sudden become my body my body is going to the store. I'm just using the word I to denote my physical body. That's all that means. So here, this isn't what we're talking about. We're talking about ahankara in a simple way as the one who has an ego. In the Western use of the term, I have some pride. I think I'm better than you. In this way or that way. I feel superior in this way or that way. Or I take, I own my gifts. I own my gifts. Like say, for instance, if you're a very, very handsome man or a very beautiful woman, this is also what Swamiji talked about. What did you do to,
to acquire the beauty?
How did you lose it?
What if you were very intelligent? You're born with a great amount of intelligence or some vibhuti Maybe you can sing beautifully, or you're very artistic, or whatever. You have everyone has certain vibhutis. But who gave them to you? How did you create them? You know? They're really all Ishwara. Or you give credit to your parents. Yeah? Your family. How do you take those as something to be prideful about? And that pride is a thing that turns everybody off. Hmm. You may have it and feel that it bolsters you up in some way, but in fact, it makes everybody else run away from you. You know, because what everybody wants is for you to see them as beautiful, or them as special, or see their talents. But if you're focused on your own talents, then the other person's worth isn't being appreciated. You see what I mean? And that makes a person not feel whole. In other words, their wholeness isn't being contributed to by you. See? So that pride becomes something which separates us from other people. And so wherever that you find any kind of pride like that in yourself, you have to ask yourself, you know, what did I really do to create that vibhuti that I have? What did I do for it? It's all Ishwara. And so what you start noticing is this becomes something in your consciousness. You become grateful for, you know, vibhutis. Vibhuti means the good things that you have, the talents that you have, your whatever it may be,
glories.
The glories that you have. If you appreciate your glories, your talents, and you appreciate other people's glories and talents as Ishwara. You know, they're all gifts. You don't really haven't done anything. They're all gifts that are given. And so when that's kind of the buddhi, you know, then you're not a person who's calling attention to yourself. And that's the beautiful, that's what they call being humble, not in a creepy way. You know, this false kind of humility. But the humbleness of recognizing other people's vibhutis as well as your own. It's also not about this kind of false humility where you don't recognize what's there. If you have certain gifts, you have certain gifts. But those gifts are gifts, you know. And everybody else has gifts too. You know, so there's something that it's very beautiful about that. And in fact, when you're with a wise person, of course, Swamiji is always my example, but because I've appreciated it so much with him, if you're with somebody who doesn't have this type of ahankara, then you feel that your gifts are being cherished by that person. They don't care about theirs in terms of something to strut with. That's not in their mind. And so they are appreciating you. And so when you're with that person, you feel appreciated. And the reason you feel appreciated is because you're being appreciated. That's such a funny thing. You can't fake that. You're feeling appreciated because you're being appreciated. And that's such a wonderful, you know, way to feel. But you can't feel appreciated when the person sitting there is only appreciating themselves. So that's the anahankara. Then the next one, janma, mrityu, jara. So janma is birth, mrityu, death, jara, old age, vyadhi, illness. The dukkha is the suffering, that dukkha dosha. Means that's the suffering that is caused, but that is natural to all of these things. Your birth, death, old age, and all the illness that comes along with the body. You see that that is natural to the upadhi, to the body. It's not like the body is not going to be born. And it's not like it's not going to die. And it is going to have to get old, unless you die before it gets old. And it will go through its own set of diseases and illness. Everybody has their illnesses, and everybody suffers for those illnesses. Illness is an interesting thing that I'm sure all of us have noticed. When you're not ill, you forget what it is. You forget. And then when you're struck by something, even it could even be something like a bad flu or a bad cold. You're struck by something, or perhaps you're struck by something a little more serious. Then it's a real wake-up call. Then you remember. Then you remember what that is. You know? It's kind of like, I've never had children myself, but what they say for a mother who's given birth, so I'll address the mothers here, you've given birth, while you're in labor pains, you'll feel, I will never do this again as long as I live. Because it's so extreme. But once your baby is born, you know, that all of that goes away. And I think that illness is kind of like that. You can really suffer and really have illness. And when you're having that illness, then you also have compassion for all the other people who who have had illness or who have illness. Because then you, all of a sudden, you can relate to it and you can understand. And then when you get well, again, you probably forget what it is, you know. And so here, this anudarshana has to do with not forgetting. It's with remembering, not in a morbid way. It's not about being morbid. It's about being honest. It's about recognizing what it means to have a body, to be born, and then to go through death, and to go through, to become old. This old age, somehow we block it out of our mind until we get closer and closer and closer, and then you start realizing what it is. It's not really fun. Old age is not fun. I still remember my mother telling me this. And they lived in this land of total denial. Amazing. But my mom, she really confided in me one day, you know. And she just said, you know, honey, it is not any fun to get old. It's not fun, you know. And she spent from about 65 until 80 with really suffering with arthritis, having basically no energy, could do very little, you know, and spent most of her day, she was an avid reader, which is great, so she spent most of her day lying on her bed and reading, you know, and trying to control the pain of this arthritis. And that went on for over 15 years, almost 20 years of having to deal with it. She was never a complainer. She would never complain about anything, you know, but she could barely move her hands, you know. And that's old age. It's old age. I mean, everybody's different, but it's not the greatest thing, you know. And that's something that every upadi, unless you die when you're young, Tibby, you have to go through. You have to go through that. I remember when I was about, you know, about 10 years old, and my mother had just, it's been a little less than that, she had just turned 30. Hi, what's going on? She just turned 30, and I thought...
She's patrolling.
Yeah. Okay, there's nothing in here, right? Anyway, she had just turned 30, and I remember so clearly thinking that she's 30, that's so old. And then I calculated, and I was still young, I wasn't even 10 yet, I don't think. It must have been, actually, if she was 30, that would have been 7 or something, 8 or something. Remember very clearly thinking, okay, it's a long time before I'm going to be 30, so I have a long time to go. You know? Because she seemed, that seemed like really old. And then I realized that at that time that I didn't want to get old. I needed to be young so I could play and do everything, you know? That 30 was, wow. This is the upadhi. Anyway, this is the upadhi. and all of the illnesses and things. And so that's what it is to have a body. And so it's just the understanding of what it is. There's a lot more in that we'll talk about in terms of a kind of a bigger picture. We think that our being, the self that we are, is intimately connected with this upadi, with this body, mind, sense organs. That we believe that there's a very intimate connection, and this is who I am. And if this were not here, then that's not going to be me anymore. No. And so I have to, I have no vairagya toward this. In terms of shobhana adhyasa, the shobhana adhyasa in terms of the deha, in terms of the body, or in terms of the body-mind complex, is so much, you know, the superimposition, you know, of me, the meanness, the ananda, the wholeness, onto this is so much that this type of seeing the limitations of this body, mind, sense organs complex is just one little aspect of putting some sort of a distance between myself and the body in terms of vairagya. It doesn't really work very well unless we understand it in terms of something else. And the something else that I think is, for me, in really gaining a freedom from my being me being superimposed on the body, one thing that really made a difference in terms of my own inner freedom around that is the dream. And by that I mean, when you dream, sometimes in the dream you are identified with a body, but only sometimes. Sometimes in the dream you are actually Ishvara. You're not identified with any body. You're just the witness of the dream, you know, where there's no identification. Sometimes in the dream there's no beings in the dream. Sometimes there's many beings in the dream, but you're not identified with any of them. When you're not identified with any of them, then you're just the whole picture. You see what I mean? You're the whole. You're not identified with one thing or another. Now, in the dream, that's perfectly normal. You don't think in the dream, when there's no identification with the body-mind complex, I've lost my body. Right? That's not what it is at all. It's just now I'm the whole. And that is as real and natural to me as being identified with the body. Now, the reason it's totally natural and it doesn't make any difference at all whether their identification is with the body or with the whole is that the me that I am is neither the body or the whole. The me that I am is the changeless conscious being from which the whole dream projects, is sustained and resolves into. And when that dream is projected, if I'm not identified with anything in it, then the whole thing enjoys me. If I'm identified with the jiva in the dream, then I'm experiencing the dream from within it, looking out through the dream sense organs. But in fact, the me, which is the self of the dream, is not becoming the jiva, nor is it becoming the whole. The atma, the self, is always exactly the same. It's not becoming anything. And so what you realize if you look at the dream, or if you play around just with your imagination or daydreaming, same thing. There is no loss of me or loss of self or dependency of me. My me being dependent upon any given form or any form at all. I don't need a form. I'm not a form, and I have never been a form. And so when the forms come and go and I recognize that, especially using something like the dream, I watch these forms come and go without anything happening to me, nor feeling weird or less. No matter what the form is, it's not like myself becomes, oh, now I've become a little small jiva, and now I'm a great big Ishwara. Atma doesn't become anything except what I am. So for me, from the standpoint of the whole infinite upadhi, the Ishwara upadhi, I'm exactly the same. From the standpoint of the worm upadhi, exactly the same. From the standpoint of the jiva individual upadhi, exactly the same. It doesn't improve me, add to me, make me bigger or smaller. Absolutely nothing happens. Same thing when you think of waking up from the dream, nothing happens. These are very important recognitions. The dream is so, so useful. Just like your imagination, using your imagination, it's so useful to be able to use it to differentiate yourself from anything that manifests. Anything that comes into manifestation, any name and form, any nama rupa, any feeling, any emotion, nothing happens to me. I'm the changeless self of all of that. Whether I have a body or I don't have a body, it makes absolutely no difference. Because I've never had a body. And I never will have a body in terms of me. And so say it like this. You don't have self-knowledge, but you have self-knowledge. If this person doesn't have self-knowledge, they've never had a body. Their self is free and whole and complete. This person has self-knowledge, okay? They've also never had a body. The self is whole and complete. Both are exactly the same. There's only one self. The one self that is there, you know, is absolutely free and is the self of all bodies, is the self of the whole, and is free of them all also. And so as you start realizing this, the upadhi, or this manifest creation, is not defining you. It doesn't define or add to your being. Your being is its very self. That's the satyam mitya. And as you understand that, this fear of my being dependent upon some sort of upadhi dissipates and goes away. Because as time goes on, as your recognition goes on, your being, the being that is you, this is another little key issue, the being that is you that you are attached to, the me, yourself, that you are attached to as an ajnani, is that me that has always been free. It is that me that is still there when the universe goes away, when the dream goes away, when the body drops. So that becomes another kind of a viveka, where you have to, you know, like in contemplation, when you're walking around, you have to say, okay, what am I most attached to here? What is the me that, if I die, that this me that makes me still remains, when we say life after death and all of this, what is it that must remain for me to still be me, or for me to say, okay, it's all right, you know, to go to these other lokas, to go to these other worlds, or to be liberated? What would it have to be, you know? Because you need these type of exercises, because what happens is these words like awareness or limitless being and all of these words are too big. Mm. And they don't necessarily land on the one I care about. So they don't work. These big words have to land on me. You have to realize that these big words are pointing to me. And then you say, oh, you mean me? You're saying I am free in this way. The I that I take myself to be is free in this way. That's what has to happen. Otherwise, what happens is, I'm me, and then there's this infinite self. But I don't care about that self. I care about me. So I have to realize that it is this me that I care about that is timeless and free from change. See the difference? These words have to land on me. Otherwise, I'm hearing about this abstract me that I don't care that much about. It's nice and everything, but who cares? It's like if I die when the body dies and there's some infinite self that remains, I don't care about that. If this body dies and I am still here, the one that I'm attached to that is actually me, if that remains, if that is timeless, if that is the self of Ishwara, then everything is different then. Because then I truly am all of this, the I that I take myself to be. And that is the I that the Upanishads are talking about. But because of language and because of the natural superimposition on the part of the mind, it's not that easy to make that shift. And also just the way we think about knowledge, because when we think about gaining knowledge, we're thinking about gaining something that we don't know. Here we're gaining knowledge of something that we do know. And we're not used to that. The self that we're gaining knowledge of is already here. And we're used to having to have an experience of the self, and then we can say, I have gained that knowledge of the self. I didn't know about that. And so you're traveling to the self. It's not that. It's recognizing that this self, the who am I question, is the who is this me that I am. These are all funny things that the mind is very tricky. You have to keep using words to tease all of this out so that the mind is kept. It's like taking the mind and funneling it in the right direction, and it starts to go off this, and you have to bring it back. It starts to go off here, and then you have to bring it back. Swamiji's used the example of it's like taking a big flashlight to the ego, to the ahankara, and you're just going like this. It's traveling, it finds another place to hide, and then the teaching comes along, and it gets that, and it scoots over there, and then it comes, you know, until every corner is lit up. And then it gives up. But it gives up to the truth of itself. And so it's a very happy occasion, actually. But until it has that happy ending, it's running scared because it doesn't want to die. The reason that ahankara, the ego, doesn't want to die is because I don't want to die. Mm. The ahankara is properly labeling me. 50% of the ahankara is correct. Mm. Because it is labeling me, but then superimposing the me that it's correctly labeling onto the body, mind, sense organs. And so when it does that, I have made myself finite. I've made myself subject to death because of that beginningless ajnanam. I'm not doing it on purpose. It's natural. But then I, that which is most dear, becomes finite. And so I don't want to be finite. So I'm struggling to save myself until I finally realize that the I that I'm trying to save is free. The one that I'm trying to save, the me I'm trying to save, is already saved, is already free. And then it's a huge relief. Then the ahankara resolves into jnanam, into the aham. And so that ajnanam-based ahankara is gone. So here with this janma mrityu jara vyadi, you know, it's just trying to give you a little distance. You're so attached to this upadhi. You're so attached to this. But this is not a very happy occasion. This is born, it is going to die, you know. It's subject to old age, it's subject to disease, it's time-bound. It's not worth it to be too attached to it. So let's try to figure out what the reality is here. That's the idea. Let's stop there. Purnamidam, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamudachyate, Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
Can you say that we're attached to our own being, or is that...
No, that's absolutely right, but then you're totally attached and in love with your own being, but then your being is superimposed upon the object, and so if your being, who you are, is superimposed on the object, then you're attached to that object as your being. Mm. Right? That's why this... It's kind of complicated. It's not complicated, really. It's just thorough. The superimposition is so thorough.
So you're not. It's not a condemning attachment, because that seems to be natural to your own truth, to your own.
It's like saying, "Are you attached to love? Are you attached to love?" Well, it's kind of a silly question, because who is not attached to love or to wholeness? You know, or to being loved. It's just the love is like all moths going toward the flame, you know, toward the light. They naturally do that. All humans, all beings naturally go toward love or toward that wholeness. That's fine. But when the love is superimposed on another object, which actually... It is the self of that object, but it's the self of all objects. It's the self of everything. It's your own being. And so the circuitous route where you're attached to the love that is superimposed on an object, then that love is away from you. And then you have to run after it. And there's a distance between you and the loved object. And the loved object can decide it doesn't love you. So all this horrible stuff happens.
Yeah, and there's also degrees of the love that you have sometimes.
That's only because of the shantavritti. You know? And so that's why I say, in contemplation, for instance, when your mind is very, very quiet, and so it's like Ananda is vibrating in that quiet mind, so that was a really, really wonderful, such a profound, deep meditation. You know? But that's also samsara. In a way, you have this profound meditation, and then the profound meditation goes away. What you really, that's nothing to put it down, and not really putting it down, except for the shobhana adhyasa. Mm-hmm. What you really want to recognize is the self that is always there, not dependent upon the mind. Not dependent upon a vritti in the mind. It's nice to have shanta vrittis, and as the shobhana adhyasa starts being pulled in, so to speak, because of your knowledge, the mind naturally gains much more shanti, because it's not asking the world to do make you happy, and so it doesn't get upset. So it has natural shanti. But yourself is the absolute shanti that is not dependent on the vritti. It's nice to have shanta vrittis. But yourself is always shanti. It's whatever the vritti is. And so that's the freedom, is the recognition of the one who is actually free. And the secondary gain is the condition of the mind that comes about from removing that ignorance, self-ignorance. That's a secondary gain. The primary gain is the self-evident me is no longer superimposed on all of the, and mixed up with, you know, all of these things that are coming and going, and then causing the poor mind to get upset. I don't want the things that are coming, and I want the things that are going. And once in a while it works out, so I get this little moment of peace. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're totally dependent on the world for your state of mind.
I think I had a moment of meditation for the first time in my life today. Because I, up till now, I've been completely lost in this thing about why can't I make my thoughts stop? And then if I could make my thoughts stop, then I thought I was meditating. And I realized that it's no more meditating to make my thoughts stop than to have my thoughts run. It has nothing to do with anything at all. And then when that thought came, then I guess it's what you're talking about, this moment of peace. So it really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all.
You know, that's actually very true. It really does not matter. The only thing that matters is that sometimes you need to make your mind quiet to whatever degree you need to make it quiet so that you can recognize the one who is there, not changing at all, no matter what the mind is doing. And that's the fact of it. And so, in fact, even in now, Swamiji and I'm doing it much more myself because I understand what he's been doing as he changes, you know. Is putting more emphasis in your teaching methodology on the satya mitya. What that, because when putting the emphasis there, you're recognizing amidst the change the very self of that, which is not changing. And so that helps to do exactly what you're saying, where you're recognizing these thoughts, whatever they're doing, how many thoughts there are, how many emotions, moods, whatever is going on in the mind, the self of that, the very self of that, is not affected in any way. And so instead of trying to quieten the mind so that you can have like a peekaboo, you know, through the quiet mind, you can recognize exactly the same thing amidst the moving mind. And so that becomes very, very valuable. So that's a wonderful insight. And you also recognize nothing's happening to you. Nothing at all is happening to you. You're not being covered. The mind isn't covering you. The emotions aren't covering you. You know, you're very much there as the one who is illumining all of that. But then the thing can come, yeah, but I don't want this harmful, agitated mind. What causes the kind of harmful, agitated mind is the lack of vairagya. And the lack of vairagya is just caused by self-ignorance, and it's habitual. There's an emotional lag time. Lack of vairagya means in your mind, your mind still feels because of beginningless ajnanam that I need this and this and this in order to be happy. And so the mind gets upset and starts, you know, creating stress and tension because this situation is, you know, all these type of things. So it takes time for the mind to work through all of that and settle down in the light of your knowledge. And it does settle down.
Carol, this thing, when you talk about the me, this was when I first came here and met you. You said that, and that was, I think, for both me and Sue, uh-huh. It was like a revelation, because it was almost like all our lives we were looking for this thing called the self.
Yeah.
We didn't realize the self is actually me.
I know, me too. That's exactly for me too. That's what happened.
And it was like, oh my God, you know, it's actually me that she's still looking for, that she's talking about. Oh my goodness. And
that's a real breakthrough.
Yeah, and there's some feel a sense with that. I wonder, you know, because sometimes even, you know, doing like Drik Drisha, Viveka, is very powerful, but sometimes there is almost a feeling that if one really just can connect with this thing, that it's really just me, this very simple me that's always here, that's always been here, that's in every situation. And in some ways, you almost don't even need to go through that analysis.
I think it's possible. I didn't used to think so, that it was possible to do it without the Drik Drisha. Mm-hmm. But now I do think that you can.
You do think so?
I do think so.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, Drik Drisha is
a more intuitive approach, maybe.
Maybe, but you just have to If you see it clearly yourself, you can do it with just satyamitya. Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's satyamitya is what you feel that this. When you're just talking about the me, that's.
That you to recognize the stable, changeless me amidst my experience, you can do it with just satyamitya. Satyamitya is you start out with, it can be called karya karana, cause effect, like material cause and the effect. But if you do that, it has to end up as satyamitya, because otherwise there's dvaita, there's duality. But you can do it. You can definitely do it, and you can use drikdrisha also. You know, just to help tease it out. But even more emphasis can be put on the satyamitya in terms of your experience.
Because something about, you know, just connecting with the me, sometimes with drikdrisha, it can seem a little bit like dissociative or something like that.
That's the problem with it. Yeah. Because with drikdrisha, you're doing a viveka, a separation.
Right.
You know, but if you do the separation, then you have to bring this back as mitya. So you separate, and then this becomes mitya, and it has to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do it with just satyam mitya. You have to experiment. Main thing is that you yourself see it, and then your students can see it. You know.
Can you say the two again? What would you distinction?
See, there's two teaching. There's many different that we call prakriyas. One is the drikdrisha, viveka. Viveka means where you discriminate between the seer and the seen. Mm-hmm. And then you objectify by that the world, the body, the sense organs, the mind, the ahankara. And in that objectification, you're able to see what you are minus these things that you've superimposed yourself on. Okay, so you're breaking that superimposition by the seer-seen discrimination. That's a teaching methodology. It's called drikdrisha viveka. But the other, there are several of them. But so right now we're comparing that, drikdrisha viveka, with the satyam mitya. It's actually called karya karana, cause effect. But the cause effect relationship, like clay is the material cause of the pot. That relationship between the clay and the pot, where the clay is the material cause of the pot, but the pot has no being apart from the clay. And so that karana, cause of the effect, karya, is a relationship called satyam mitya, where what is real, actually there, is the satyam. And in this case, it's the self, which is changeless. And the nama-rupa is mitya, means it has no being apart from the self. It can't touch the self, it doesn't change the self, but it's not away from the self at all. And so when we're working, so this is called, you can just say satyam mitya or the karya karana prakriya. Prakriya means teaching methodology. So now when you're doing that, one nice way to do that is say, if you're just, as you're unfolding, you can say, you know, in meditation, you can say, you are this body. Just let yourself be this body, feel this body completely. Recognize your me, the very being that you are, as this body. You know. And then what you can do is, now you have the experience as me as the body, remember that with the satyam mitya, if I use the clay pot, the pot is the clay. That's true, right? The pot is the clay. The body is the conscious being. The body is me. Right? And you do the same with the mind and the same with the sense organs. But what you're starting to recognize is that the body is me, but I never change. The body changes. The perceptions of the body change. The experiences of the body change. This me that is the body is not changing. Well, these experiences are changing. And so I'm not now doing a drikdrisha, seer seen. I'm recognizing it's more like clay pot. And what is so wonderful about that is you already know you're the body. You know, the me as this body is already fully in place. Right? And so the very me that you're attached to as the body or the body mind, that's very much in place. And so accepting that you're the body, then you can recognize yourself amidst this body, so to speak, as the changeless self of it. And so the emphasis is different. And it doesn't cause you to have to extract yourself. So you start to recognize the changeless me within the changing, mm-hmm. without having to, as though, dissociate. Yeah. You see what I mean? So the thing is, and then you have this what they call Avesta Traya Sakshi, which means the witness of the three states of experience. And then the Panchakosha Viveka, differentiating between the five koshas. What you have to do is get all of them, be proficient, work with all, unfolding all of them. And then what you do is you bring all of them in at different times to get that well-rounded. And you know what the limitations are? Like each one has its strength. You know, and if you see one like the Drikdrisha has this, can make a kind of a dissociation, then you have to compensate for that. Like that, you have to, you know. All of the stories, all of it, you know, like the water bucket story and the wave ocean and the clay pot and the tenth man story. There's some very standard stories. They're all visionary. They're all, you use them.
Yeah. What did you call
this
one? The five layers?
Panchakosha Viveka. It's like Drikdrisha Viveka. The Panchakosha Viveka is, again, differentiating the Atma, the self, from the five koshas, the physical body, Anamaya Kosha, okay. Pranamaya Kosha, okay. Manamaya Kosha, Vijnanamaya Kosha, and Anandamaya Kosha. It's just Viveka.
Yeah, you know, the subject-object of Viveka, that almost is a borderline philosophy or kind of a... It takes kind of an academic mind construction a little bit.
Well, it's not supposed to. If you're using it as a prakriya, as a teaching methodology, then you have to make the student be sitting with the physical body, you know, so that you're aware, sitting with the physical body, and then you realize, you know, what is internal to that physical body and what is internal to that. So if you're using these as prakriyas, as teaching methodologies, you have to make the student actually be focused on what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just in the head. Mm-hmm. And it's not doing its job. Then it's just like this philosophical thing. But if the words are taking your mind along with it, then it's a visionary. It makes you see. That's what you have to do. Otherwise, you're not using it as a pramana. Mm. Right?
You know, it seems like also that there's a certain synchronization that needs to be happening between satyam and mitya, the recognition of both of these. Do you know what I mean? It's like in a certain way, it's like I can recognize satyam now, and then I can also be aware of you know, it's just kind of having the understanding of satyam, but also being like totally able to apply it moment to moment to moment to mitya. So that actually satyam and mitya is just two sides of the same coin, right?
In a sense, right? And then you have to see like this, that, you know, the Upanishads, like there's so many verses... in the all these prakarana granthas like Tattva Bodha and Atma Bodha, Panchadashi, all of these, they are going at the same vision, using all these different prakriyas, all of these unfoldments, because the mind is a complex structure. And it has to see this from so many different angles. You know, so that what is satyam and what is mitya, there's no place where that's not so. And that means that Viveka has been thorough.
You know, the interesting thing, it goes back like years back when I asked you this question about it requires a certain kind of memory, you know, to be aware of this fact that how satyam and nitya are actually moment to moment, how I'm actually experiencing that, you know, mm-hmm. So intellectually just grasping mm-hmm. it as a concept, but to kind of really get it experientially. And I remember you were saying, it's not a matter of remembering, it's a matter of seeing it.
Yeah. And remember, yourself doesn't go anywhere for you to forget it.
Yeah, yeah. Right. But it's kind of interesting how that seeing still kind of unfolds in its own kind of time and space phenomena.
Yeah.
And you can't push the river, kind of.
Yeah. That's it takes its own time.
Yeah.
The clarity takes its own time.
Well, did you just say you can't remember the self?
I'm saying you don't need to remember it because it's never gone. You have to remember things that go away. But if something's always there, there's no remembering it because you don't have a chance to forget it.
Yeah.
Right? The one thing that never goes away is you. Mm-hmm. Right? So once you really have been recognized as you, that you is not going to go away for you to forget it.
Yeah, because when I use my memory, the thing that I remember is gone.
That's right, and you have to bring it back.
Yeah.
Here, what's happening is there's a removal of the ignorance that caused the superimposition for you to take this me that is... Once that ignorance is removed, what it is that the me that is you, that has always been you, is just now released from the ajnanam, the ignorance that caused you to superimpose you on these other things. But it's still the same you. So then you realize, I've always been free. I've never not been free. That's very obvious. You know, because the me that is free is the me that I've always been. It's just now, this ajnanam that caused the superimposition is gone now. That's why they say knowledge is ajnana nivritti, the removal of ignorance. It's not the gain of something new. It's the removal of ignorance from what is already there, which is you, right?
I think what has to be remembered, I face this question a lot. People ask me about it, and it's the same kind of thing, like how do I remember who I am? But I think what is really being asked is how do I remember how to remove the ignorance to see if I already know this, like prove it to me. And I just have a lot of compassion for that. Like, the desire, there is something that wants to be remembered, or the mind thinks that it has to remember something. What are the steps I need to take to see what I already know?
Yeah. How to pull your mind back.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because the mind has a life of its own. Mm-hmm. You know.
But it's also another vritti. It's just another vritti.
Yeah, but that other those vrittis can take you on a long ride.
Yeah.
So how to be with that? That's why all this, you know, all this inner child work and how to deal with all of the emotions and traumas and ways to really be with that. And then after I've taken care of the little ones inside, taken care of the unconscious, then I can bring my mind back with knowledge. And so I learn all of these ways to handle, you know, the mind that is habitual. It's been habitual since beginningless time. Mm-hmm. Habitually motivated by ajnanam, and it doesn't just go away. You know, that's why they use these examples like you come to class and it's like the reeds in a swamp being pulled open for the moment. You know, and then you go out from the class and the reeds go... So, I mean, these are examples, right? These are time-tested examples over thousands of years. You know, so it just speaks to the habitual mind and how it's so used to responding to the world. You know, and so it sees, but then there's so many vrittis competing with that little moment of clarity, you know, that it takes time. That's why you don't just do shravana once or the teacher says, this is what it is, leave, everything's fine. It doesn't work like that. The mind has to really see over and over from many different standpoints.
Well, what would you say to that urge to try and remember? Right? Like, I have to remember what what I saw at the time of teaching. I mean, there's a...
Well, that's okay. Say that you feel that, then you just bring your mind back. That's saying, my mind is saw something, I recognize something, and now I don't feel that way. So then you have to bring your mind back. But there'll come a time when your mind is doing that. What is often the case is that you are equating yourself with a state of mind. And so the mind, yourself, has gained the status of a vritti. And see, that's another reason why the satya-mitya type of prakriya is so helpful. Because that is just allowing you to be whatever you are and recognize yourself in the midst of it. And so then what you can do is, okay, now I'm like this, or now my mind is like this, and here I am in the midst of this, here I am in the midst of this. You know, rather than thinking, oh, now I need this shantavritti to get a peep into the pratyagatma who is residing inside somewhere, shining out at everything else. So, not that that isn't good. You also can't just dismiss that drikdrisha. It also has its value, so... But it has its limitations, and they all do. So that's why you have all of these things.
Well, hopefully we can do this one meditation when we get a chance.
Yeah, such a nitya.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. You remind me next time, I'll do it for us.
Father, can I ask one more question? So it's almost like this is different kind of approaches to see. It's almost like a sense that intuitively you have to find your way through it, what is right at a given time. Is that right?
I mean, that's that is right.
It feels to me, it's like that one thing might really work at a particular time, and then it doesn't anymore. And then or something else comes along, and it really works. You know, I mean, it's all in the context of the same thing, but intuitively knowing that.
That's right, and right. I think that's true for each student, and I think that in the teaching itself, what the constellation of the people in the class bring about, also which prakriyas are being used at a given time. Because there's not, you can't have a, this knowledge is much bigger than, it's not some of the teacher's ego that is, you know, trying to create the class type of thing. It's the prakriyas. The prakriyas that are necessary for everyone in the group take place. I think that's how it is. Swamiji's talked about that too, and I feel that that it's that way. And I felt like when I was a student, I'm going to the class, I would always feel, you know, like, ah, that's just what I needed to hear, you know, at the right time. And then finally something that I really needed to hear would come. You know how it is?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you know? Everybody has their own little path of what they need at a given time to really see it. And then you see this, but now that you've seen this, then you can see this. And so somehow all of these things take place in the way that they're supposed to.
Somehow.
We need that shred down.
Somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's too complicated, you know. So you need to have some shraddha that Bhagavan is taking care of this, taking care of us properly. Because it's too complicated to see what the route is for everybody. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
They use that word somehow in India a lot.
Yeah.
You know, somehow.
And it's interesting to say there's like all this methodology, but there isn't really a formula per se, right?
And that's why Swamiji won't teach much about it, because he doesn't want it to become a formula. He said it isn't a formula.
Mm-hmm.
But then all these things have to be known. But then it has to take place. You know.
But also certain things are more, like you said, more relevant. Like certain mythology might be totally irrelevant for one person, but it might be very relevant for another.
That's right. Certain stories, certain mythology, certainly everything. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. You just have to extract what you need for your own kind of...
That's right. And you just hope that that Bhagavan is taking care of you. That the different things that are unfolding are the somehow fit your order.
That's true what you just said, though. I mean, there is a grace involved with
there's
this.
There's
well,
a bubble.
It's exactly what you're saying. Uh-huh. It's without the ahamkara. It's all like just happened.
Yeah, it happens.
I mean,
it has to happen.
Use those words.
Yeah.
There's something more than just the learning process. I mean,
the learning process is individual for every person.
Yeah. But then it seems like you pray for a blessing, and you pray for this insight to take in yourself. I mean,
yeah, we have all praying. Please. Okay, let's stop.
We're all praying that the insight take place in you.
Yeah, okay. Please do that.